President Bush in his inaugural address as he began a second four-year term in the White House. The president's new focus on promoting freedom and confronting tyranny could create new challenges for America's relations with countries that are important for the United States, but far from democratic. On the program today, we'll examine China, a country of vital geopolitical and economic importance to the U.S., but a one-party state that tolerates little dissent and is accused of serial human rights violations. To begin, I'm joined on the line from Beijing by James Miles, China correspondent for The Economist. James, did the Chinese leadership have any reaction to the president's inaugural address?
Well, I think they took it in their stride. The Chinese, I think, have come to a different view of the Bush administration. Now America is very much preoccupied in Iraq. It sees China as much less of a threat and indeed regards it as having been rather cooperative. It has made positive noises, at least, about supporting America's anti-terrorism campaign globally. It has tried to cooperate with America in resolving the problem with North Korea.
In the public response to the president's words about the conflict between freedom and oppression, there was not implicit any assumption on the part of the Chinese that, hey, he's talking about us?
I don't think so. I think although you see now as you have for a long time in Chinese rhetoric, the idea that America wants to remake China in the American mold, that kind of rhetoric still crops up from time to time in the official media. But it doesn't really affect the way Chinese policymakers handle this relationship.
Does the Chinese leadership believe that economic relations will trump any problems over human rights and freedom?
I think they hope the growing and increasingly vital economic relationship between China and the United States will blunt demands in America for radical political change in China. And I think in that strategy, they may well feel that they are succeeding. And I think there is a general recognition in the United States and among its allies in Asia that cautious, measured change in China is the best thing to pursue. And if that means putting up with the Communist Party as it is for quite a while to come, then so be it.
James Miles, Beijing correspondent with The Economist, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
As President George W. Bush lays out a bold agenda for promoting democracy in his second term, history offers several lessons about how his approach might affect America's relationship with Beijing. As Garrick Utley explains, America's interests and America's values have often coexisted uneasily when it comes to China.
During his campaign for the presidency, George W. Bush made clear that he would adopt a tougher approach to China than his predecessor, Bill Clinton.
The conduct of China's government can be alarming abroad and appalling at home. China's government is an enemy of religious freedom and a sponsor of forced abortion. China is a competitor, not a strategic partner.
9:03 a.m., a sickening sight.
But then came September 11th. The war on terrorism went to the top of the Bush administration's foreign policy priorities. Confrontation with China turned to cooperation, as China's leaders saw an opportunity to improve relations with the United States. President Bush changed his tone, too. 5 weeks after the September 11th attacks, he spoke at a news conference with China's president, Jiang Zemin.
We have a common understanding of the magnitude of the threat posed by international terrorism. Today's meetings convince me that we can build on our common interests. We seek a relationship that is candid, constructive, and cooperative.
The Bush administration's quest for a relationship with China anchored in common interests has deep historical roots. For most of its 4 millennia of history, China had little contact with the outside world, which it considered culturally inferior. Westerners were referred to as barbarians. By the middle of the 19th century, British merchants and British gunboats forced China to open its markets and culture to contact with the West. The United States also benefited from Europe's gunboats, signing treaties with China that granted special economic privileges and permitted U.S. missionaries to spread Christianity among the Chinese. By the end of the 19th century, the Chinese displayed growing resentment towards foreign powers interfering in their internal affairs. A secret society called the Boxers unleashed attacks that killed hundreds of missionaries and foreigners. Troops from several countries, including the United States, intervened to rescue their citizens and put down the Boxer Rebellion. The events were popularized in the film 55 Days in Peking, starring Charlton Heston.
All right, Marines, this is an ancient and highly cultured civilization. So don't get the idea you're any better than these people just because they can't speak English.
During the Boxer Rebellion, the United States proclaimed its famous open-door policy. It supported free trade and opposed the partition of China among the imperial powers. Although the Chinese welcomed America's policy, the United States took little action to restore China's independence and sovereignty.
Along the eastern seaboard of America, bound for France, were shiploads of troops fresh to war and high in morale. The Yanks were indeed coming. Now that America was in, well, she was going to be in with all it takes.
President Woodrow Wilson declared that America's great purpose in World War I was to promote democracy and self-determination around the world. Wilson openly supported China's aspirations for full sovereignty and independence. At the Versailles Peace Conference, the Chinese delegation hoped that Woodrow Wilson would support China's sovereignty and force Japan to give up the territory it controlled in northern China. But when Japan threatened to leave Versailles and refuse membership in the proposed League of Nations, President Wilson gave in to Japan's demands. In the United States, Wilson's decision was criticized as a betrayal of American principles. In 1931, the Japanese launched a brazen attack to increase their control over China's northern province of Manchuria. But the League of Nations took little action, even as Japan's attacks escalated in 1937 to a full-scale, brutal war with China.
Over Shanghai, Japanese planes began a systematic softening up, the first bombs of World War II. For it was there, on the beaches of China, as far back as 1937, that in truth the second great struggle for the world began.
President Roosevelt initially opposed economic sanctions that would have halted the sale of American oil and war materials to Tokyo. But by 1941, it was clear that the attacks on China were part of a larger policy to dominate Asia. After Pearl Harbor, America and China became allies in war, sharing a common interest and a common enemy.
In the Pacific, we're pushing the Japs around, and we're not going to let go of it. We shall not settle for less than total victory.
Despite the wartime alliance, there were signs of future problems. The Roosevelt administration was suspicious that the Chinese nationalist government, led by Chiang Kai-shek, would use American aid not to fight the Japanese, but to continue its struggle against the communist forces of Mao Zedong.
As communist forces threaten to engulf all China, the evacuation of European civilians from the danger zone begins in earnest. The 9th American Marine Division from Guam arrives at Qingdao.
After the war, top Truman administration officials believed that the Chinese nationalist government had lost popular support and that a communist victory in China was inevitable, short of massive U.S. military intervention. The Truman administration made a fateful decision not to intervene. China fell to the communists, and China's nationalist government fled to the island of Formosa, which today is called Taiwan.
In Moscow, too, a conference, as Molotov, recently appointed deputy to Stalin, goes to Yaroslav Station to welcome a comrade from the Far East. With the Red Victory in China opening the Pacific to Russia, Mao Zedong is summoned to the Kremlin to be given his role in the Cold War.
It did not take the newly communist China much time to sign a pact of friendship with the Soviet Union. Within months of the Sino-Soviet Pact, North Korea's forces launched a massive invasion against South Korea in an attempt to unify the Korean Peninsula under communist rule.
The aggression against Korea is the boldest and most dangerous move the communists have yet made. The attack on Korea was part of a greater plan for conquering all of Asia.
The Truman administration rushed U.S. forces to defend South Korea. America and China were now at war over Korea. America's national interests and its democratic values led to a policy of containing China in Asia. Under President Eisenhower, the United States supplied military aid to French forces in Indochina and committed itself to the defense of Formosa.
President Eisenhower signs an historic congressional resolution granting him authority to defend Formosa at the risk of war. The resolution, Ike says, asserts our determination to resist communist aggression.
By so asserting this belief, we are taking a step to preserve the peace.
But by the 1960s, America's attempts to contain both China and the Soviet Union in Asia had stretched America's resources and will in a costly and divisive war in Vietnam. At the same time, cracks began to appear in the alliance between Communist China and the Soviet Union.
Both Russians and Chinese call this northern Manchurian waste the sacred soil of the motherland, but they disagree on whose motherland it is. In the March 2nd skirmish, the Russians lost 31 frontier troops killed and 19 injured.
As the Nixon administration was trying to negotiate itself out of the Vietnam War, it also began quietly reaching out to China. Mao Tse-tung responded with an invitation for a U.S. ping-pong team to visit China.
America's first ping-pong match with the Chinese in Peking turned out to be an impressive display of warmth and good feeling. 18,000 Chinese were in Peking's new capital stadium, built during the Cultural Revolution and opened only last year. They cheered and applauded, as much for the visitors, it seemed, as for their own players.
In 1972, President Nixon made his dramatic trip to China, an event that changed the way Americans viewed China and, indeed, the shape of geopolitics.
The Great Wall, also a reminder that for almost a generation, there has been a wall between the People's Republic of China and the United States of America. It is not our common beliefs that have brought us together here, but our common interests and our common hopes.
America's historic rapprochement with China was widely hailed as a success of Nixon's and Henry Kissinger's realpolitik. China was a reality with which the United States had to live, and Nixon built a relationship based on common interests, if not always common values.
Our moral sense dictates a clear-cut preference for those societies which share with us an abiding respect for individual human rights.
With President Jimmy Carter's inaugural address in 1977, there were high expectations about the important role that American values would play in America's foreign policy. Carter publicly supported dissidents in the Soviet Union and human rights in other key countries. But his administration paid much less attention to human rights in China. In 1978, the Chinese leadership launched the economic reforms that would make China an economic power to be reckoned with. With economic liberalization came pressures for greater political freedom. The signs of trouble were largely overlooked by the Reagan administration, which was eager to promote trade, investment, and strategic ties with China.
Well, today, China's economy crackles with the dynamics of change. Unlike some governments which fear change and fear the future, China is beginning to reach out toward new horizons, and we salute your courage.
Reagan's successor, George Herbert Walker Bush, strongly believed in the strategic relationship with China. He traveled to Beijing shortly after taking office. But just a few months later, that relationship, based on national interests, was shaken by the bloody confrontation in Tiananmen Square.
The noise of gunfire rose from all over the center of Peking. It was unremitting. On the streets leading down to the main road to Tiananmen Square, furious people stared in disbelief at the glow in the sky, listening to the sound of shots.
On June 4, 1989, the Chinese government sent tanks and troops to put down student protests. The violence and killing were seen on television screens around the world.
And so I say again, what is the vision of our new covenant? An America that will not coddle tyrants. From Baghdad to Beijing.
During the 1992 presidential campaign, Bill Clinton criticized the Bush administration for placing America's interests above its values in the relationship with China. But once in office, he recognized, as previous presidents had, that America had other important interests that were difficult to ignore.
I have decided that the United States should renew most favored nation trading status toward China. Will we do more to advance the cause of human rights if China is isolated? or if our nations are engaged in a growing web of political and economic cooperation and contacts. I am persuaded that the best path for advancing freedom in China is for the United States to intensify and broaden its engagement with that nation.
By the mid-1990s, the island of Taiwan had flourished into a thriving democracy, strengthening its bonds with the United States and presenting a sharp contrast to the repression in neighboring China. In March 1996, China began large-scale military exercises on its coast near Taiwan and fired missiles that landed 30 miles from Taiwan's main ports.
The United States has rarely deployed this much naval firepower in the region since the Vietnam War. The aircraft carrier Independence and her battle fleet now steaming towards Taiwan. Their firepower is formidable.
The United States responded with its strongest show of force against China in decades. It sent two aircraft carriers into the waters near Taiwan to deter Chinese military action. And 3 years later, NATO forces accidentally bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during the war in Kosovo, unleashing a torrent of anti-American sentiment in China.
Good evening. The biggest and angriest demonstrations for 10 years have swept a number of Chinese cities in response to NATO's destruction of China's embassy in Belgrade, with the loss of four lives.
When President Clinton left office, the United States had developed important economic interests in China, but uncertainty and mutual suspicion remained. And now President Bush has reaffirmed his commitment to spread freedom.
We will persistently clarify the choice before every ruler in every nation, the moral choice between oppression, which is always wrong, and freedom, which is eternally right. We will encourage reform in other governments by making clear that success in our relations will require the decent treatment of their own people.
How will President Bush balance the principles of freedom he wants to spread with the pragmatism the United States has often chosen in dealing with China? A China whose power and confidence and ambition continue to grow. I'm Garrick Utley for America Abroad.
Next on the program, our eyewitness segment looks back at the Tiananmen Square student demonstrations and the government crackdown in 1989.
There were huge numbers of Chinese coming out of their apartments, almost to a man hostile to the troops coming in. They were throwing stones at them, they were cursing them.
None of us assume that we can survive after that many innocent people have already been killed.
Plus, a look at the role that economics plays in determining America's policy toward human rights in China when America Abroad continues. This is America Abroad. I'm Ray Suarez.
爱国有理!
爱国有理!
打倒官僚!
打倒官僚!
Chinese students marching toward Tiananmen Square in May 1989. For just over a month, the square became the center of China's democracy movement. Until the People's Army deployed its tanks to put down a protest by the people. The Tiananmen Square demonstrations and the Chinese authorities' decision to crush them presented difficult challenges for America's policymakers. As America Abroad's Margaret Warner reports, the crackdown shook the foundations of the Chinese government and an American policy based on geopolitics and national interests.
The images are still with us. A lone student facing down a Chinese tank. Students erecting a replica of the Statue of Liberty in Beijing's main square. The crisis of Tiananmen Square unfolded over just 6 weeks, but the seeds had been planted 10 years earlier, when China's leader, Deng Xiaoping, began opening the country's tightly controlled economy to the West. James Lilly, U.S. ambassador to China during the Tiananmen Square events, had spent the 1970s in Beijing as a CIA operative.
This communist totalitarian state that we'd all lived in the 70s was changing. And there was a freer press, freer mobility, more openness, Chinese students come in here en masse. Arthur Miller went there and gave Death of a Salesman. Shirley MacLaine went there and found her soul on Huashan Mountain. And the Chinese, the students, the middle class was beginning to push upward, express themselves.
One of the young people touched by this new openness was a teenager, Li Lu.
Most of our generation went through a culture kind of awakening, in the sense that we, for the first time, have seen a comparison in life, what a free person could have lived in outside China and what it's like living in communist China. So that comparison was so compelling that most of the people of my generation have collectively come to the decision that we want to live in a different life.
But China's communist rulers were not granting many new political freedoms. Only one senior official was heard advocating those reforms.
The Chinese leader who was doing a lot of this was the Secretary General of the Party, Hu Yaobang. And Deng has about enough of him around 86. I don't think you get the point. Political liberalization isn't going to happen. You're going to have opening up free markets, and you're going to have a controlled society.
For straying from the official line, Hu Yaobang was drummed out of the party leadership. But Hu Yaobang exacted a revenge of sorts when he died of a heart attack.
When Hu Yaobang passed away on April 15, 1989, all of a sudden we lost our champion. We felt maybe it is time that we will bring our case directly to the people themselves. Maybe it is time for us to push the party into reform by organizing popular demonstration.
Thousands of students, including Li Lu, marched to Tiananmen Square in the heart of Beijing. The Chinese leadership seemed paralyzed over how to respond.
Zhao Ziyang and Hu Qili are beginning to say, handle this thing peacefully. Get an agreement with the students. Li Peng and company are saying, you've got to reestablish discipline and break this thing. People's Daily comes out with a very tough editorial, which says, in effect, the students are counter-revolutionaries. That's treason.
The student really was so angered that simultaneously there are a few hundred thousands of people came out the very next day to the street against tens of thousands of policemen and staged one of the most spectacular people's demonstration, 200,000 students.
As the crowd swelled, the Communist Party's new general secretary, Zhao Ziyang, tried to initiate a dialogue with the students, but it went nowhere. At the same time, the world's media began to pay attention to the unfolding drama, thanks in part to an impending visit by Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, himself a reformer.
The students clearly are playing to the international media. And the Gorbachev thing, in they come. Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, Tom Brokaw, Bernie Shaw. What a chance. You can make your statement. It goes around the world. Those newsmen realize Gorbachev, Deng Xiaoping reconciliation is not the thing. It's the protest movement in Tiananmen Square.
On the eve of Gorbachev's arrival, hundreds of students, including Li Lu, began a hunger strike in Tiananmen Square.
We know that was a radical move. Once we sort of take that step, there was no coming back. We all sort of in the back of our mind believe that the hunger strike is going to probably be our ultimate sacrifice.
Gorbachev came and went. Then Ziyang made a dramatic visit to the square.
He made a very, very moving speeches to the students. He said, well, I came too late. I really had hoped to come earlier. And my heart goes with you. And please stop hunger strike. You're still young. You should preserve your life. The future belongs to you. You know, it was very exhilarating that the head of the party came to the Tiananmen Square. On the other hand, he basically said, look, you know, I'm too old. There's nothing I can do. Of course, it turns out at that point he already lost his power struggle.
The students decided to heed him and end their hunger strike. But the government had already declared martial law. As Chinese troops moved toward Beijing, thousands of ordinary citizens took to the streets to block them from the heart of the city. In an equally defiant step, the students erected an enduring American symbol of democracy.
There was a popular belief that the United States would be on the side of people who fought for democracy and freedom. That is why, towards the end of the movement, we actually erected a statue, which we call Goddess of a Democracy, which is an exact replica of Statue of Liberty, and tell people that American struggle for freedom is our inspiration.
By the night of June 3rd, the Chinese government had had enough. Its tanks and troops started forcing their way toward the square to remove the protesters. But many ordinary citizens put their own lives at risk to try to stop them.
There were huge numbers of Chinese coming out of their apartments, almost to a man hostile to the troops coming in. They were throwing stones at them. They were cursing them.
But the troops and tanks didn't stop, and they killed crowds of men and women who refused to get out of their way. Li Lu was among the students waiting for the troops in the square.
None of us assume that we can survive after that many innocent people have already been killed. At least that's how I felt, that a captain should really kind of die with the sinking ship. All we did was sitting quietly, hand in hand, in the middle of Tiananmen Square under Heroes Monument, singing the songs that inspired us. We believe that if we have to die, we must die in dignity.
Yet Li Lu says the student leaders also realize they shouldn't ask thousands to die with them. After negotiating a withdrawal, they began to leave. It was then, Li Lu said, that one tank followed, crushing a dozen departing protesters. The student leaders felt double-crossed.
We thought we were going to go back and collectively to mourn our dead colleagues and perhaps to die together with them. At that point, there were a number of citizens who came out of their home and tried to find the surviving students who would kneel in front of us and basically beg us to leave, and basically saying, look, they're no longer human, they're animals, and they will kill you all if you go back. China needs you in the future. And so in the end, we were persuaded by those people. So finally, we decided to continue our march back to the campuses. And that is how the last few thousand survivors of a Tiananmen demonstration left Tiananmen Square on the morning of June 4th.
Most of the world reacted with pure outrage to the Chinese government's brutal crackdown. President George H.W. Bush, who'd been the first U.S. envoy to Beijing in the early 70s, was also concerned about preserving the budding U.S. relationship with China. Richard Solomon was Assistant Secretary of State for Asian Affairs in the first Bush administration.
He had become a tennis partner of many Chinese leaders and had a very positive, I would say, Nixonian view of the importance of China as a strategic partner of the United States.
James Lilly said the president also had developed an affection for the country when he and his wife Barbara lived there.
They liked to get on bicycles. They took Chinese lessons. He learned his chopsticks and Chinese food. And he said, this country is a real big country, and it has to be our friend. We can't fight these guys. We have to work with them. I think this made him sympathetic to China and willing to, I think, rationalize some of their crueler habits.
So the president's first comments on the Tiananmen massacre tried to strike a balance.
The United States cannot condone the violent attacks and cannot ignore the consequences for our relationship with China. This is not the time for an emotional response, but for a reasoned, careful action that takes into account both our long-term interest and recognition of a complex internal situation in China.
The Bush administration suspended U.S. military sales and contacts with China, yet did little to undercut U.S. trade or investment there. But Congress imposed economic sanctions, and many criticized the president for not taking a tougher stand himself. In late June, Ambassador Lilly was suddenly called back to Washington. Bush told him he wanted to send National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft to meet secretly with Deng Xiaoping. In early July, Scowcroft and Deputy Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger made their secret trip to see Deng.
When they saw him, he wasn't contrite at all. He said, we are defending our motherland against chaos. These people were challenging our system. They were not showing contrition, but the fact that we made this move and that they knew that Bush had in some ways put his political career on the line for China. And I think this really advanced our position so that later on when I was there, we could get a great number of things done.
And news of the trip leaked back in Washington. That added fuel to the fight between the White House and Congress over dealing with China. Within a year after Tiananmen Square, the Chinese government did lift martial law and released hundreds of political prisoners. But James Lilly and Li Lu disagree on why.
It was under the intense pressures from the American government and particularly in American Congress, and particularly when that pressure was backed up by the threat of trade sanctions, that the Chinese government have released tens of thousands of people out of jail right after Tiananmen.
James Lilly, however, credits the Bush administration's more pragmatic approach.
I think they did it because they were dealing with Americans that understood the importance of sustaining the relationship, rather than continuing to punish and harass them on their obvious mistake they made at Tiananmen.
One thing is certain. The Tiananmen Square crackdown badly soured the American public's view of China. Public support in the U.S. plummeted and has never returned to its previous level. Debate continues even today on whether the Tiananmen Square protest advanced the cause of reform in China or set it back. Richard Solomon was Assistant Secretary of State for Asian Affairs in the first Bush administration.
What it did do was pull the rug out from under the more reformist element in the Chinese leadership, and it undoubtedly slowed down what we still hope will be a much more dramatic opening of China.
But James Lilly thinks it at least led to more economic freedom.
These students have to be bought off. And the Faustian deal is, we're going to take care of you. You can have your new Honda or your mobile phone, but keep the heck out of politics. It's dangerous. So were the students able to change China? Not in the real sense. Did China change because of the students? Partly, because the government knew that they'd gotten things wrong.
And Li Lu believes he and his fellow protesters advanced political change at Tiananmen, and that even the Chinese leadership knows it.
I have had the chance to meet with a whole bunch of different Chinese communist officials at different levels in the last 15, 16 years. Don't ask me why they want to meet with me, but they did. I have never encountered one situation in which the government would not admit it was a mistake to use troops against the ordinary people. Because in the end, that decision have a forever put into question of the legitimacy of the Chinese communist regime.
I'm Margaret Warner for America Abroad.
America's policy of economic engagement with China has led to huge trade and investment flows between the two nations, and it's helped bring increased prosperity to hundreds of thousands of people in China. But America's policy is also supposed to help bring greater freedom to the Chinese people over the long term. Steve Roberts explores whether and how America's economic interests have helped drive political change in China.
This is my toy chest.
And what's in here?
Yes, what are called toys?
They're called toys? And where is this one made, Jack?
Caboose.
It's a caboose? Where do you think this one's made?
China!
In fact, most of the toys in my grandson's toy box are from China. When Americans think of the relationship between China and the U.S., inexpensive imports usually come to mind. That and the jobs that have moved overseas because of cheaper labor. What people often forget, according to Nick Lardy from the Institute of International Economics, is the huge benefit to U.S. consumers.
Well, there certainly is a paradox here. A lot of people that are quite concerned about the loss of jobs then rush out and buy their clothing at Walmart and other mass merchandisers who are very cost conscious and increasingly are sourcing their goods from China, whether it's apparel or electronics or other products.
But this is just one half of America and China's close economic relationship. China is now the world's third largest importer of goods, many of which come from the United States. America is sending over everything from pigs to commercial aircraft to a vast country newly swimming in cash. Nick Lardy believes that to some degree, the policy of trade and investment has helped create a rule of law in China, which encourages political change.
Now, you can't stand up in the square and say, overthrow the Communist Party. You will be arrested and you will disappear into a very unpleasant jail for a very long period of time. But there is accountability. People are also suing the government for economic harm that has come to them or the failure of the government to enforce its own laws and regulations. The very idea of being able to sue the government for failure to perform is, I think, a revolutionary one. It doesn't get headlines in the United States, but it changes the whole psychology of the political process.
But some Chinese say the pace of change has been far too slow. Lisa Fan is a member of Falun Gong, a Chinese spiritual movement which has seen its members continually harassed, jailed, and even executed by the government. She says that the human rights situation has gotten worse in her home country and that America's economic relationship with China has not helped.
As far as U.S. government, I feel we're not being strong enough. A lot of times China used the political and the economic pressure to pressure Western countries to adapt their home policy. And unfortunately, a lot of times our business people and politicians not stand strong enough.
Dissidents like Yang Junzhao say that China's market reform has merely emboldened those in power to seek profit. He says that when you mix a communist political system with a capitalist economic system, you get the worst of both worlds. Now, ideology is tainted with a quest for money and power. The result is widespread corruption.
Before 1989, even the Chinese authority and its officers, they were working with the wrong political idea, with communism. But they were pure. They were pure in their devotion and their mandate of working for the people. But right now, they just use their power for their personal goals.
Someone who says he has seen the corruption in action is John Kam. Once an American who did business in China, now he spends his time asking the Chinese government to release political prisoners. Mr. Kam is a new kind of diplomat. He's not backed by any government, and he uses delicate, behind-the-scenes negotiation, not public political pressure, to win prisoners' release. John Kam says he comes from a long line of salesmen, and that although his father sold whiskey, he sells human rights.
You go in and use all the skills you have learned as a business person. You go in very, very well prepared. You approach it in a way that you think will have the highest probability of success, without compromising any basic principles in the process. And you're ready to keep going back, and that's where it gets tough, because justice delayed is justice denied.
Mr. Kam says the political activists are not the only ones suffering at the hands of the communist regime. He tells the story of a young Chinese-American Stanford grad who returned to China to start a medical equipment business.
A tax official came to let him know that a problem had arisen and that if he paid a certain fee, the problem would go away, and Jude threw him out, and the next day the cops came and arrested him. The long and short of it is he was finally sentenced to a very long term, I think 16 years. He has the evidence that he paid the tax. It's very frustrating because no court wants to overturn another court. It does entail somebody saying, oops, we made a mistake. And with the Chinese government, that's still very, very difficult.
Hank Chow now owns the Chinatown Garden Restaurant in Washington, D.C. Mr. Chow agrees with Nick Lardy that the international community cannot expect political change overnight.
You don't get democracy. You earn democracy. This country, U.S., when was the first time a woman has the voting rights? So it came along a long way. I think gradually you will see from the small town to big city to the province. So that will force people on the top to make changes.
Mr. Chow points to local elections in China as a sign that grassroots change is happening now. He says that kind of change will have more impact on the current situation than rhetoric from abroad. John Kam says he does believe there is a role for outsiders to play in reforming human rights in China. What he envisions would be a merger of America's business interests and its political values.
I really believe that business people, if we could ever figure out a way to convince them that this really was something they should do, business people would be tremendous activists. We haven't seen that yet in the area of human rights. Yet, but it's coming.
The sheer magnitude of the Chinese market, with its billion-plus consumers, is a reality that is difficult for the United States to ignore or isolate. But debate will continue about just how the United States should complement its extensive trade and investment in China with pressure for greater political freedoms. It is a debate likely to grow after President Bush's inaugural address. Will strong words from President Bush inspire activists within China to push for more reforms? Will open markets create a growing middle class that demands more from their government? Or will non-governmental actors use quiet negotiation to slowly change the political culture that stifles democracy? I'm Steve Roberts for America Abroad.
Next on the program, what next for the U.S.-China relationship? Our roundtable discussion when America Abroad continues. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is America Abroad. We close our program today by gazing into the future with three recognized experts on China. Kenneth Lieberthal served in the Clinton administration as Special Assistant to the President for Asia and also as the National Security Council's Senior Director for Asia. Today he's on the faculty of the University of Michigan and a visiting scholar at the Brookings Institution. Min-Jin Pei was Assistant Professor of Politics at Princeton University from 1992 to 1998. Currently, he's a Senior Associate of the China Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And Arthur Waldron is the Lauder Professor of International Relations at the University of Pennsylvania. Marvin Kalb began by asking Kenneth Lieberthal whether President Bush's inaugural pledges to root out tyranny worldwide and stand by the oppressed will have an impact on American policy toward China.
I frankly don't think they'll have a very large impact for two reasons. One is I think that President Bush will pursue this policy in a careful fashion with China. We have a lot of real interests at stake, not only economic, as you mentioned, but also strategic interests with China. And the president is not going to want to sacrifice those by taking a rigid, all-or-nothing kind of stance on the words you just quoted. But beyond that, the Chinese argue, and with at least a modicum of real meaning to it, that a lot of the changes taking place in China are improving human dignity. They're increasing people's access to food and sustenance, to a better quality of life, to information, to richer cultural experiences, to more life choices, and so forth.
Dr. Pei, what is your judgment?
The Chinese are very realistic. First of all, they would not interpret President Bush's recent pronouncements as a change in policy toward China specifically. But on the other hand, they're not going to be totally insensitive to the political pressures the president may be under in terms of human rights in China. We heard that China was willing to allow American government officials examine China's prisoner list. And that may not be a direct response to the president's remarks, but certainly it suggests that the Chinese government will, under certain circumstances, be responsive to American requirements that China opens up its political system aligned with its economic system.
Professor Waldron, what would be your call on this?
Well, I think that what the president said is not to be dismissed, and I think that it's likely to be beneficial. So I would say the challenge is not so much for the United States, although I think we have to be true to our word. The real challenge is to a Chinese government, which has now unleashed all sorts of social forces and aspirations, but somehow thinks that it can avoid the next obvious step, which is genuine liberalization, freedom of speech, elections, and so forth. And I think that's coming.
Well, I think there's a problem of talking about this as if it's an either-or proposition. If you're asking whether China will have a nationwide multi-party system with democratic elections in my lifetime, I frankly think the answer is, unfortunately, very unlikely to get there from here. But if you ask whether the system is likely to evolve in a direction that is more tolerant of its citizens, builds in greater protections for them, I think that all those are also trends that are very prominent in China.
My own view is that we're going to see very substantial political change in China quite soon, but above all, because this is what the Chinese people want. When I'm in China, I often ask, you know, could you in Shanghai elect a mayor? Well, of course they could elect a mayor. And I think if you had elections in China, that would be a good thing. If you had freedom of speech, if you had newspapers, which even had something as simple as USA Today, where they have two editorials, one pro and one con. But this is all being resisted by the party. It's not a case of sort of micron by micron progress. The party is trying to draw an artificial distinction between economic change and political change. And in fact, the two are closely related.
The problem is that China has been one of the fastest changing societies in the world from the early 1980s till now. And somehow putting it the way Professor Waldron put it suggests that no change has occurred, or that any change that has occurred is so superficial as to not be worth paying attention to. Let me just finish, please. And I don't think you could find many Chinese who would agree with that assessment. I think the changes that have been made have been very significant.
My view is this, just to put it bluntly or simply. China today has the kind of educational system, it has the kind of standard of living and so forth that is creating citizens. That is to say, these people are no more subjects. In many areas, they are quite autonomous, they manage their own lives and so forth and so on. And if you create millions of people who have all the attributes of citizenship, and then you say to them, no, but when it comes to politics, you can't participate, I simply think, as a historian, I can't think of any examples of that working.
Dr. Pei, how is the will of the Chinese people to be represented, to be felt, to be a decisive influence on the pace of efforts towards democratization?
I think the reality is very, very complex in China. Certainly, different regions are evolving at different paces. And if you want to look at how people's will is being expressed, you can see it's being expressed in the media. The Chinese media is becoming far more independent than we normally understand from the West, through the expression on the internet as well. And also, occasionally there are local elections. Sometimes those elections can produce pressures for change. So by and large, I'm not saying that China is becoming a democracy, but China today certainly has limited public space for citizens to express their will.
Dr. Liebethal, there's a lot of speculation that if China is experiencing this much vibrant economic growth, and if there is going to be a collision between the economic growth and kind of the constrictions on the political side, that at a certain point there is an explosion. Do you believe it is possible that there could be an internal revolt within China that dramatically changes the landscape?
Yes. I think that a precondition of that revolt would be a clear and open division at the very top of the political system.
Among the Chinese leaders,
which would signal to the population that the system is paralyzed because there's no clear direction from the top. There is always a lot of tension in Chinese society. Urbanization is proceeding at an historically unprecedented pace. Migration at an historically unprecedented pace. Privatization at an extremely rapid pace. Opening to the international economy at an extremely rapid pace. All of these are unsettling, in addition to political tensions over lack of responsiveness of the system. So the place could explode, but I think it will explode only if the top of the system essentially becomes openly paralyzed. And then you would have an eruption. Now, what would happen in the wake of that would depend, but it's very likely, more likely than not, that once they resolve their problems at the top of the system, order would be restored. And it would be a very ugly scene.
It would be crushed.
It would be crushed, but actually the way what we saw in 1989 is typical in China. If we could see an explosion in China, yes, I would be astonished to see the outcome of that explosion be something like a liberal democracy.
Dr. Pei?
I see the likelihood of a sudden revolt or an implosion, explosion in China as fairly low. But on the other hand, if China does not speed up its political reform, that there's a huge disparity between China's economic system and its political system, then its economic dynamism may actually be dissipated over time because the political system does provide the foundations for sustained economic growth through a more secure legal system, through a less corrupt political system.
In closing, for all three of you, and I will start with Professor Liebethal, very broadly speaking, if you look ahead 10 to 20 years, do you see the United States and China as friends of sorts engaged in a cooperative relationship, or is it going to be tense and possibly even with certain terrible military consequences?
Either of those futures that you suggested is feasible. It will depend upon decisions made in Beijing and in Washington. There are some in both countries who assume that 15 years from now our relationship will be antagonistic and who argue that we had better start taking the measures now to make sure the other one can't do us harm. That is as clear a prescription for a self-fulfilling prophecy as you can come up with.
Dr. Pei?
I think the overriding interests of both countries will dictate in the next 10 years at least they will continue to work with each other. But I do not see that 15 years from now, China and the U.S. will be locked in an existential conflict with each other because the common interests between the two countries are simply overwhelming.
And Dr. Waldron, please.
My own view is that in 10 or 15 years, there's going to be substantial regime change in China. And I hope and expect that that will be in the direction of liberalization and democracy, because that's really the only way forward. If you want to develop, you have to free the creative abilities of your people, give them full access to information. And if you want to have stable politics, the people have to be invested in the politics. They can't simply be consumers or receivers of politics. They have to be makers of it. Nearly all of its neighbors are democratic. Frankly, I think it's coming. I just don't think they can hold it off.
The comments of Arthur Waldron concluding our roundtable discussion, which was moderated by Marvin Kalb. And that concludes this edition of America Abroad, a production of America Abroad Media. The executive producer is Aaron Lobel. Our senior producer is Simon Marks. The production team includes Nicole Sanglier, Eason Erkin, Amanda Kavasazi, Nicole McPherson, Jenna Diaco, and Jerome Netter. The sound engineer was John Ogulnik. Steve Martin is our director of marketing. Our theme music was written by David Kane. Archival audio came from British Pathé, the BBC, Vanderbilt University Television News Archive, CNN, and the Truman, Carter, Reagan, and Bush Presidential Libraries. With Margaret Warner, Steve Roberts, Marvin Kalb, and Garrick Utley, I'm Ray Suarez for America Abroad.
Support for this program comes from the Ford Foundation, the Star Foundation, The Economist, and the Draper Richards Foundation. Support also comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide, and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Programming on WILL is made possible.